Welcome to the JPGN Journal Club, hosted by Dr. Alex Nicely and Dr. Jake Mann.
Well, I'm back again, and so is Jake Mann. And I flatter myself, Jake is too modest for that, but I flatter myself that you might have missed us and that you welcome us back. Today, ESPGHAN Journal Club is, as always, here to educate, to inform, and to keep you out of trouble, by which I mean, as we approach the holidays, to keep you out of the shops. Don't overspend. Stay at home. Read. Listen. Learn. And speaking of learning, Dr. Jake Mann will tell us today what he thinks we should know. Jake, you've dipped back, a couple 10 months. To the beginning of this calendar year, in order to select 2 articles for presentation and discussion. But they share a theme, which is that of inflammatory bowel disease. You're giving us something from Lancet Gastroenterology and Hepatology, a collaborative project spanning 6 years and half of the globe, on maintenance treatment with vedolizumab in pediatric inflammatory bowel disease. 54-week outcomes of a multi-center prospective cohort study. All right, clinicians, consider yourselves satisfied, and now it's time for the histopathologists, who may be only me, from Journal of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition, Rebecca Little and co-workers, all at Toronto's Hospital for Sick Children and the University of Toronto, Intestinal Histopathology in Pediatric PSC-IBD, Characterization of Phenotype and Assessment of the Nancy Index. That, of course, is from Journal of Pediatric Gastroenterology and Nutrition. So, Jake, tell us about vedolizumab. And what's its name when it's at home? Is this Entyvio? Is this vedolizumab? What's going on here?
For me, it's always been vedolizumab, but then I have never been really one for the brand-specific names. I'm sure other people have got a more friendly name they give it.
Right, and this is a monoclonal antibody, a humanized antibody first developed in mice, if I remember correctly.
Yes, and very excitingly from my perspective, it's really developed out of all the evidence for leukocyte trafficking biology. So it blocks a specific integrin, alpha-4 beta-7, which sits on the surfaces of leukocytes. And that integrin binds to a partner on endothelial cells that tends to be expressed in the intestinal tract. So if you block that integrin, you reduce the infiltration of white blood cells into an inflamed GI tract.
Hold for just a second. I know this, and I'm going to protest against the phrase alpha-4-beta-7 integrin, is abbreviated in usual English as LPAM1, that is, lymphocyte Peyer's patch adhesion molecule 1. Are the lymphocytes that express this integrin, this dimer, restricted to Peyer's patches, or are they only more concentrated there?
They're certainly heavily concentrated within the GI tract. I don't think that it's exclusively within Peyer's patches, but they bind to MADCAM1, or mucosal-associated adhesion molecule 1, which is a mucosal-linked expressed endothelial adhesion molecule. What I haven't looked up is whether it's also expressed in other endodermal-derived tissues, like in the lung.
Well, I'm here for you, Jake, as always. It is prominently expressed in synovium. How about that? People are thinking about using vedolizumab in arthritides, if I don't misremember.
I love the word arthritides.
I made it up just for you. Anyhow, once integrin alpha-4, beta-7, and its partner are activated, what happens?
Well, it essentially allows firm adhesion of the leukocytes to the endothelial membrane, therefore they can then transmigrate into the submucosa and then propagate inflammation. And there's good evidence in adults that if you block this pathway in patients with inflammatory bowel disease, then they do better. And it seems efficacious both in terms of induction and remission of IBD.
Walk us through where tumor necrosis factor and blockade of tumor necrosis factor fit into this picture.
Well, TNF is a very commonly secreted cytokine, which is predominantly acting in a paracrine fashion rather than endocrine, and or distant sites. And TNF-alpha-based inflammation is heavily prominent in IBD. So the anti-TNF-alpha treatments, typically infliximab and adalimumab, are very good at reducing the pro-inflammatory cycle in IBD.
I'm inferring from this that these steps in the inflammatory process are downstream from alpha-beta integrin.
In general, yes. But then I'm hedging because the vedolizumab would reduce the infiltration of circulating leukocytes, which obviously will be one component, but there are resident immune cells, a huge number of resident immune cells within the GI tract, which will also have a role in initiation and propagation of inflammation. So I would be hesitant and hedge my bets by saying if you're not entirely blocking all leukocyte infiltration using vedolizumab.
Oh, fair enough. So vedolizumab then has been approved and entered the pharmacopoeia in adults with inflammatory bowel disease that doesn't respond to tumor necrosis factor blockade or to corticosteroids, or whose IBD does respond but who are steroid-dependent with adverse consequences. Have I got that right?
Yep, exactly.
And as always, children are the proverbial red-headed stepchildren, and they have to sneak from the table what crumbs the adults leave them.
A nice analogy for drug development in children.
Which is to say that it's being used off, vedolizumab is being used off-label as a, well, we might as well try this, what we have isn't working approach. And it's been reportedly efficacious, but not, at least in the long term, in a prospective study.
Yes, and particularly looking at long-term maintenance treatment. There's been, prior to this paper, there have been two shorter, smaller studies, but they were really focusing on induction therapy. And in those groups, it seemed to show efficacy. But this is a larger cohort, 64 patients with Crohn's, 73 patients with UC, who had a mean duration of IBD for 2 to 3 years prior to starting vedolizumab. And then they aimed to see that what was the proportion after a year who were in remission whilst being steroid-free or free of exclusive enteral nutrition.
What I liked about this cohort that they assembled from all these institutions is that it was a dirty cohort. People were finding excuses not to exclude people.
I think a dirty cohort is probably a good way of putting it, that there was substantial heterogeneity within the included participants. One of the key points for me is what treatment were they on prior to starting vedolizumab? And out of all the patients, I guess it was interesting that not all the patients had previously been on a biologic. Mm-hmm. So only 66, 70% of those, which I guess in the first instance, I don't understand how they've come to go on to vedolizumab without having tried infliximab or adalimumab before. And very few of the patients had tried both, evidently. They'd only three patients had been on two classes of biologics.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess what's not what wasn't clear to me, unless I'd missed it, was exactly how the patients had come to get vedolizumab.
Mm. And I have to confess that if that's in the paper, then I skimmed over it too. And I confabulated the idea that vedolizumab was being used as a long pass downfield, as somebody repeated the Hail Mary full of grace.
Yes, and it's what you would do if you had a kid who had really difficult to treat IBD that wasn't responding. I don't know practically how I would go about getting it. Compassionate use basis or individual application, it will probably vary from country to country. And I think that that's probably why we've ended up with a mixed bag of patients. They've included all the relevant data that is available, but this isn't I get the vibe that it may be to an extent opportunistic as to anyone they were able to treat and able to include, they have.
Mm-hmm. And yet, even working in the real world as opposed to a totally controlled and totally homogeneous study population, they were able to get decent results.
Yeah, there seems to be reasonable response to both. Let me just find the exact numbers.
Week 54, complete remission, 25% of children with Crohn's disease, 47% of children with ulcerative colitis.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, do I have to repeat? I'm here for you.
Thank you.
Okay.
The only caveat I would have to that is just imagining a kind of UK setting, it would be likely that the newer, more expensive drug would be recommended as a second line, so you'd want patients to have formerly already failed on both infliximab and probably adalimumab mm-hmm. prior to going on to it, which would then therefore further select a worse, more severe, more resistant disease cohort, and you would therefore envisage that they may have an even poorer response.
Well, I'd like to talk just a little bit about the authors claim that adverse effects were few. What kind of adverse effects are you expecting to show up in a one-year, 54-week treatment interval? Lymphoma, for example, is a conceivable adverse effect, but it's early days for that to pop up, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, it would be bad luck either way around, but longer-term treatment, you would imagine, it's a cumulative risk, and therefore the longer you're on the treatment, the higher overall your lifetime risk would be of it.
And the rest of the adverse effects that were reported were things like headache, hmm?
Yes, the kind of typical bag of adverse effects that you would see. The ones that you, would most worry about would be the significant reactions at the time of infusion, kind of anaphylactoid type response, but they didn't seem to be described in a significant way. They did talk about one patient having a leukocytoclastic vasculitis, which, if I'm being entirely honest, I don't understand exactly what that would look like.
It means that there are fragments of leukocytes associated with the vessel wall damage.
Thank you. You are always here for me. I suppose I meant more from do they present with crashing renal failure, or was it a cutaneous vasculitis, or I'm assuming this is a smaller vessel vasculitis.
Yes, sir. And I apologize. I always forget that you're a clinician at heart.
Either way, it doesn't sound like a bundle of fun, but and one out of 137 is still a non-insignificant risk.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting to me as well were that, by their count, ulcerative colitis patients responded better than did Crohn's disease patients. Any comments on that?
I think that's not uncommon in IBD trials. That... particularly in children with difficult to treat Crohn's disease, it is often, well, harder to achieve sustained remission in patients with Crohn's, and they're more overall more likely to relapse than patients with IBD. Patients with ulcerative colitis.
And something that also intrigues me is that response at 6 weeks and again at 14 weeks seemed to prognosticate fairly well. If you're going to respond to the regimen that was employed, that is, then you're going to respond by 6 or 14 weeks, or you might as well go back and rejigger the regimen.
Yeah, so I guess one of the key points of this study was that demonstrating its evidence as a maintenance therapy, because there'd already been previous data to suggest it's good at induction, and this I suppose is consistent with that, that if you respond during induction, then your outlook from a maintenance perspective is probably good. Whereas if you don't respond, then it may not be so good. And when you carefully look at those curves of the disease activity index, there is the suggestion that the patients with Crohn's disease tended to gradually do better over time, with kind of overall increasingly low disease index towards the year, whereas the patients with ulcerative colitis, it sort of flattened out. They responded and then continued to have low activity, albeit with substantial variation. But you'd need more numbers to formally prove that. And another thing, if you look at figure one, these are two graphs that are showing the disease activity indices over time for patients with Crohn's disease and UC. For those with UC, you get the impression that the disease activity went down quite quickly in the responders at week six and then more or less plateaued, albeit with variation. Whereas with Crohn's disease, albeit it wasn't powered to demonstrate this, but you get the impression that there may be some degree of persistent reduction in the disease activity index all the way up to 1 year. So perhaps there is ongoing improvement in the patients with Crohn's.
Well, two very quick comments further. I'm interested in what will be done with such patients after the year of therapy. Will they be maintained, continue to receive vedolizumab?
I think that the exact dosing regime has not been figured out beyond this. This is as far as anyone has got. But if it's done in a similar way to patients with infliximab and adalimumab, you generally would try and stretch it out to as infrequent as possible without rocking the boat.
Okay, and the other thing is, here we've got patients who respond by 6 weeks or by 14 weeks. They've got bad actor inflammatory bowel disease, by definition, because they're involved in this trial. And you've got patients who don't respond by 14 or 16 weeks. The people running this study are fairly clever, and I do wonder if they've got cells in their freezers to compare the call it the inflammasome and the genes that encode for it, or that encode it, to compare between the responders and the non-responders, possibly permitting prediction before trying vedolizumab.
Yeah, the sort of pharmacogenomics aspect of it is very interesting. I guess I would also wonder, was there something different about their circulating leukocyte populations Did they have a different abundance of cells expressing this specific integrin, which meant that they were less likely to respond to it?
Well, Jake, we've been playing in the fields of the Lord, which is to say in clinical inflammatory bowel disease, for long enough. We have to move along. We have to deal with the retrospective study of Nancy indexing in children with inflammatory bowel disease. Endoscopic mucosal biopsy specimens from children with IBD associated with primary sclerosing cholangitis, 50 of them, and IBD independent of PSC, 81 of them. And this is an attempt to find a histopathologic correlate to the observations that the clinical and endoscopic features of IBD and of PSC-associated IBD vary. What do you think of this paper? Why is it important for us to know?
I think that it is another piece of the puzzle highlighting that PSC-associated IBD is distinct from IBD in the absence of PSC. And the kind of classic, at least medical school level teaching, is that you get IBD and then you get PSC, or the two can happen at the same time, but it's sort of one disease. And sometimes I forget and also get back into that way of thinking. But this is a reminder, one piece of the puzzle to illustrate that there are differences.
As your pocket histopathologist, I'd like to launch a caveat to the idea of extrapolating from retrospective histopathologic studies, where all the slides are lined up in a row and it's the same people each time doing the study evaluation and everybody has had a good breakfast and nobody is fighting with his or her chief, which tends to result in less inter-observer variation and less intra-observer variation than with, okay, here's another three trays of slides to get through, and God, we have to do the Nancy index again. The idea of prognosticating from a particular Nancy index handed out by what the Germans call a Feldwald- und Wiesenpathologe, your common garden variety pathologist, as opposed to a specialist, and a specialist who has everything about the Nancy index at her fingertips and her microscope stage, is, I believe, substantial. So, yes, they've identified in this study that there are some features of the inflammatory bowel disease of PSC that are not addressed in other staging systems or other grading systems, including the Nancy system, which is valuable at the level of distinguishing features and possibly pointing to pathogenetic mechanisms. But as far as working from your pathologist's Nancy index in your patient's specimens, I'm skeptical.
So you're saying that you wouldn't extrapolate this to say, oh, the Nancy index was different in this patient to this patient, and therefore they're going to get PSC.
I'd like to know who assigned the Nancy index, if it was the same person, and if they'd had a good breakfast on both days.
Breakfast is important.
Breakfast is important. And with that, we can release our listeners to breakfast, lunch, dinner, or a snack. But stay away from the mince pies and stay away from the gingerbread. You don't want to go into the new year looking like me.
See you soon, Alex.
Bye-bye now.